The Shoreshine Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Hello, everybody. This is Bill, and this is our Torah portion commentary on the portion called Bamidbar, or In the Wilderness. Of course, this begins the book of Numbers, also known as Bamidbar, chapter 1, verse 1, and we'll go through chapter 4, verse 20. Now, just as we begin, I'm going to give you just a little background information just on the book Numbers, or Bamidbar at large. The oldest name for this book is the fifth of the musterings. In other words, it was saying that one of the five books describes the numberings of the legions of Israel. And then later it became known by the fourth word in the opening sentence, which is Bamidbar, or in the wilderness. The name Numbers actually comes from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. The book of Numbers, or Bamidbar, deals primarily with the laws and the history of the Mishkan during the wilderness years. But it's more than just a chronicle of historical information, but a lot of things shared with us where we see that it interprets these events as well, so that we can glean spiritual concepts and precepts from it. For instance, it becomes clear that the Mishkan, and then later the temple, was to serve as a permanent substitute for what happened at Sinai. In other words, the sanctuary served the same purpose as the mountain did. It's just a mobile version of that. And so the awe and the fear, I guess would be a proper word, that set in with the people when they saw the mountain on fire, enveloped in smoke, heard the rumblings and the thunderings and the sound of the shofar, and then God speaking to them with an audible voice, that great experience continued with them in the Mishkan, all through the wanderings in the wilderness, and then again, as I said, later on in the temple. So again, the sanctuary served the same purpose as the mountain. It was just a mobile version, if you will, because the sanctuary being in the midst of the camp, in a sense, Sinai was going to stay with them, though they journeyed away from the mountain itself. And so just as they camped around the mountain, they would camp around the sanctuary. In fact, we're going to get into a lot of that, how they camped around the sanctuary. So consequently, Bamidbar contains commandments about the sanctuary, in particular, how to safeguard the sanctuary, how the tribes, as I mentioned, were to encamp around it, how the priests were to dismantle it, to transport it. Now, as a whole, the book of Numbers is divided into three primary sections, chapters 1 through 10, which contains laws given in the wilderness, and that will include the first census, the ordeal of jealousy, the Nazirite vows, some of those things that we're going to cover in this portion. Later on, the supplementary Passover, the consecration of the altar, the priestly blessing, again, some things that we'll cover in this portion. Chapters 11 through 21 covers the 38 years of wandering until they arrived at Moab, and it included points about the appointment of the 70 elders, the punishment of Miriam, the mission of the 12 spies, or I prefer scouts, Korah's rebellion, the sin of Moses, the commandment of Tzitziot, the rites of the red heifer. So all these different things contained in Bamidbar. And then finally in chapters 22 through 36, it will describe the final events at Moab, including the prophecy of Bilam, or Balaam. And that led to the zeal of Pinchas and how he stopped a plague from sweeping through the camp and destroying everybody. And then, of course, toward the end, the appointment of Joshua as Moses' successor. So, in short, the book of Numbers, or Bamidbar, forms a transition of sorts from Vayikra, or Leviticus, to Devarim, or Deuteronomy. Now, the mustering, or the numbering, of the people began 1 month after the erection of the Mishkan, because in this we will see that Moses will number all the men of military age, that is 20 years old and up, by tribal affiliation. And the total number was 603,550 people. Now, there are rabbinical sources that cite the opinions as to why God wanted the people numbered. and I'm just going to list them for you here. Number one, to demonstrate the miraculous growth of the nation from 70 people who went down to Egypt, 603,550 people. Another reason given is that each person, every individual, had a right to benefit from personal attention from Moses and from Aaron. Another reason given is that the tribes had to be arranged properly, and so a count had to be made. And this count was necessary because they were about to begin a military campaign in the process of subduing the land of Canaan. So these reasons were given. Perhaps there are others, but these are the primary reasons that are given for why a count was necessary. Now, with over 603,000 people, that is just males, and that is just males 20 years old and up. So that huge population infers a probable population of over 2 million people. Some estimates have it being over 3 million people. Nobody knows for sure, but you can just about count on it was at least 2 million people. And that's quite a large number of people. And so how did such a large population exist in a barren, arid desert? Because we would suppose that the land did not produce enough for them to live. Some argue that the wilderness does not mean desert, but it actually just means uninhabited. Of course, I think it means both, because it's uninhabited, no doubt about it, but desert also, because if Sinai is where I think a lot of people think it to be, that is in Arabia, that would be in the desert. So yes, uninhabited, but yes, in the desert as well. And so they were fed miraculously, is the point, not by what was growing in the land, but fed miraculously by manna from heaven. God sent them quail on a couple of occasions, and he gave them water from a rock. So the point is, he brought them into the wilderness, Bamidbar, and he took care of them there, because they had nowhere else to turn. Not only that, but consider that Midbar, wilderness, is also Midaber. And Midaber is the Hebrew term to speak, implying then that he brought them, Bamidbar, into the wilderness, that he may Midaber, that he may speak to them, implying that what truly fed them was not physical bread, but the bread that comes from heaven, that is his word. Because man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So now as we begin looking at this Torah portion, let's go to chapter 1, verse 1, and we see that all of these events begin to occur on the first of the second month, which is the month Iyar. So all of this begins on 1 Iyar, which is exactly 1 month after the first of Aviv, when Moses set up the tabernacle. And verse 2, he's told to take a census according to their families and according to the headcount, that is, the tribes. There was a census before this, if you'll recall, back in the book of Exodus, and that particular census had counted the nation as a whole without recognizing the tribes. And the reason for the distinction in these two censuses is, according to rabbinical sources anyway, because until the Mishkan was established as the focal point in the life of every Israelite, there was a danger that tribal affiliation could lead to factions and could lead to divisions. But once the Mishkan had been established, and once that had become the focus, tribal affiliation would actually be helpful if one considered the role of the tribe as it relates to the overall purpose of Israel. So tribes serve the goal of establishing the Mishkan, or the worship of the Creator, as being central. And as tribes, they were distinct only in terms of the role that they would play for national unity. Here's why I wanted to address that. Today, there are many in the Messianic movement who are overly concerned, at least in my opinion, about which tribe they are from. Some are more concerned about that rather than establishing the fallen tabernacle of David, which Amos chapter 9, verse 11 speaks of. I believe that that should be the focus. In other words, we are running around looking at all these other little things. And I'm not going to say that these things that we're looking at are important, but if these things lead us away from the central focus, and that is his presence in our midst, then these things will tend to be divisive. They'll bring factions, a lot of hard feelings or hurt feelings, just all kinds of things. So each facet is important. Every tribe is important. But after the foundational issues have been established. In other words, Yeshua put it this way, though he was speaking of an entirely different issue, I think the principle still applies. He says, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." That's in Matthew chapter 6, verse 3. In other words, if what his heart is seeking and what is most important to his heart is what we're seeking, then all of these other issues will fall into the proper order. So again, the tribes were not acknowledged in the sense that they were counted by tribe the first time, because the focus was building and erecting the Mishkan. But once the foundational issue had been addressed, and once the most important issue had been addressed, then they could count the tribes. And so what I'm saying is, in this day and time, our focus, I believe, should be sensing what is important to the Father's heart. And I believe that is to raise up the fallen tabernacle of David, which is to say a united kingdom of Israel, with you and me included in that. And then all these tribal affiliations and all these other little issues that we discuss and sometimes debate and sometimes break fellowship over will fall into their proper place. There are 12 tribes. And when the New Jerusalem exists, when the New Jerusalem comes down from heaven to the earth, those 12 gates have 12 tribes written on them. And when you go into that city, you're going to have to go through one of those gates according to whichever tribe you're associated with. Nevertheless, the important thing is not the tribes' names per se, but the fact that the New Jerusalem is here. And so, like matter, what we need to focus on is raising up David's fallen tabernacle, establishing God's purposes for here and now, and let him sort some of these other details out later. So the point was, in focusing on all of these other issues first, it tends to divide rather than to unite us as one people. Because if he is to be in our midst, there cannot be strife. There were no iron tools used in building the temple, not in the temple site. And that was to suggest that iron represents war and strife, and the Creator was not going to permit the sounds of war and strife, division, to be heard in his house. So again, if he is going to be in our midst, there cannot be strife. And therefore, we must focus on inviting his presence into our midst in the persona, if I can put it that way, of restoring David's fallen tabernacle. Now, Israel did not literally count heads, but numbered the people by the half shekel that was given per person. And so each person, 20 years old and up, who, according to verse 3, was able to go forth to war in Israel, would contribute a half shekel. And once those half shekels were collected, they were counted. And then, of course, you know how many people you have. As I said in verse 3, it says that you were to count those who were 20 years old and up who were able to go forth to war, because as they go forward to Canaan, it is to be as a zeva or a host or an army, not as unorganized rabble in these runaway slaves, but as an army, as a people. And so the counting of the people was to see, in effect, who was fit for battle. And so the aged, the infirmed, the maimed, they were exempt from the numbering because obviously they wouldn't be fit for battle. So prophetically speaking, only those who are prepared for battle and only those who are prepared to possess the land are counted. Now verse 4, it says that one man from each tribe would aid Moses and Aaron in the counting of that tribe. And so these princes and these leaders of the different tribes, when their tribe, or when it was time for their tribe to be numbered, then that person would aid Moses. And the inference there would be to ascertain or to confirm if those who counted were actually of that tribe. Now, the first one that is mentioned is Elizur. Elizur, Eli, God, or my God, Zur, a rock or protector. And so the first one mentioned means, his name means, God is my rock or God is my protector. In fact, of the 24 names given, the 12 princes and the 12 fathers of those princes, of those 24, 9 include El, which is translated God. 3 include the word Zur, which is rock, and rock is used to as a metaphor for God, perhaps I should say it that way. And then 3 include Shaddai, or Almighty. Now, Shaddai is a term that most everybody is familiar with, and it's a word that implies the giving of benefits or a provider. And the point is, in Shaddai or El or Tzur, these people, these Hebrews, had a vital attachment to the God of Israel. They, in their very name, spoke or bore witness to him. Now, the last name on this list of leaders is a fellow by the name of Ahira, who was the son of Enan. Now, Enan, that name, is synonymous with Ayin, which means I. So the first one is, God is my rock, or God is my provider. God is my protector, by implication. And the last one is Ayin, or I. So the rabbis make this connection between these two names where Israel's destiny is concerned. And it's from Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 10. The scripture says, he found him in a desert land and in the wasteland, a howling wilderness, which right there tells me they were in the desert. He encircled him, he instructed him, he kept or protected him as the apple of his eye. And so the fact that God found him in the desert, protected him, and kept him as the apple of his eye, or eyeing, this is how rabbinically it's understood, how the names, the first and the last one in particular, how they speak of Israel's destiny. And the bottom line is that God is going to protect them because God has made them the apple of his eye. Now in verse 18, it says that they declared their pedigrees. That would suggest that their births were investigated, their ages, etc. Now interestingly, both censuses, the first one we refer to in the book of Exodus and this one, are 7 months apart, and yet they have the same exact total. How is that? That's a mystery. Because you would think that over 7 months, maybe somebody died. But nonetheless, this is the exact same total, and so it's a mystery. Now, am I going to explain the mystery? No, because I don't have the answer to the mystery, and I don't think anybody does. Now, the text goes on and gives us different totals for the different tribes. But in verse 47, we see that the Levites were not counted among them because the Levites did not go to war. Which, by the way, the fact that the Levites are not counted among them when they were counted among them before complicates the mystery of how the two separate counts are identical. Now, the Levites, of course, had proven their loyalty to God in the aftermath of the golden calf incident, and so they were elevated to the status of being God's own legion. And their distinction was demonstrated in this way. They would be counted separately, and they would be counted differently from the rest of Israel. They would be assigned to guard the Mishkan and the courtyard. Their camp would surround the Mishkan and the courtyard, and the rest of Israel, their camp, would encamp around the Levites. So they were given special position to the tabernacle and to the courtyard. They were not counted as those who were going to go to war because they were God's legion. In verse 51, when it came to dismantling the tabernacle and transporting the tabernacle, non-Levites were forbidden to take part in this. In fact, they're warned in the text that if they approached this process, that they would in fact die. Because even the disassembling of the sanctuary is considered to be holy. The tabernacle does not lose any sanctity just because it's being dismantled and transported. even in exile, his temple, which, according to Paul, is our bodies, are to be holy. In other words, what I'm trying to stress here is that God looked upon his sanctuary as being holy regardless of the fact that it was being dismantled. If it was erected, if it was dismantled, it was still regarded as holy. And so it was not to be mishandled. So what I'm saying is, in one sense, if we are to be focusing on the restoration of David's fallen tabernacle, or the Mishkan, if you will, or the temple, or whatever word works for you, then that would suggest it's not erected. And in a sense, it's dismantled. And of course, what we mean by that is we are in exile as his people. We're outside of the land of Israel. And the Messiah is not sitting upon the throne of David as of yet, and ruling the nations with a rod of iron. And that's what we're working toward. So it's dismantled, if you will. Nevertheless, we are, as his people, to retain that sanctity and that holiness. In fact, we could argue that because it is, quote unquote, dismantled, that we are scattered, it is incumbent upon us even more so to retain that sanctity and holiness, because we are not to profane his name among the nations. Now, in verse 53, it says that the Levites shall pitch around the Mishkan. That is, they shall camp around the Mishkan, in a sense, as a bodyguard around the palace of a king. This would prevent non-Levites from coming in contact with the holy vessels, etc. And so they were to safeguard. Not that God needs protecting, but the sanctity of the Mishkan must be maintained. God's holiness must be guarded in order that death does not strike others. And so again, God doesn't need protecting. And yet there is this principle of his holiness being guarded by those who are assigned to that post, so to speak. Adam, in the beginning, was told where the garden is concerned, which I believe is the first earthly sanctuary, by the way, to tend and keep, but literally that is to work and to guard. He was not only to work in the garden, but he was to guard the garden. Later on, we see in Genesis chapter 3 that the cherubim were posted on the eastern approach to the tree of life to guard the way to the tree of life. And the reason, I believe anyway, that they were placed there to guard the way to the tree of life, other than the obvious that we see in Scripture, that lest man take hold of it and or eat of it and live forever. Well, that had been Adam's job. And so when Adam failed in that responsibility, then the cherubim were put there to guard the way to the tree of life. And of course, cherubim are later, the cherubim are part of the kaporet, or the mercy seat, of the Aron, or the Ark of the Covenant, to quote-unquote guard the presence. Now in chapter 2, we get into the arrangement of the camp. And verse 2, we're told that every man with his own standard, according to the ensign, in other words, every tribe was assigned to a camp. So every man's assigned to a tribe, and every tribe is assigned to a camp. And that the people were to encamp according to his tribe, and that tribe according to its camp. And every camp is going to have a standard, and every tribe is going to have an ensign. The word degel is to say the standard or the symbol of the camp of the three tribes. 12 tribes, 4 camps. So there were 4 deglim. Now the ensigns were the smaller banners, and that distinguished the individual tribes. So again, when it says standard, it's referring to the 4 camps. The 4 camps, each comprised of 3 tribes. And so each camp would have a standard. But all 12 tribes would have an ensign. In other words, they were arranged like, well, in the army you have corps, which would be the camp in this particular case. And then the corps is divided into divisions, which in this case would be tribes. The tribes, or the divisions, were then categorized by families within the tribe, which would correspond to a regiment. So in other words, not only are they being counted or mustered according to their ages and for preparation of a military campaign, they are being organized in the same way, by corps, by division, right, by regiment, if you will. But in this case, it's camp and by tribe and by family. So the camp and the tribe had their own standards. Again, so to assign military as well as familial organization, because Israel at large is also considered his legions. Now, tradition teaches concerning this division that it was assigned in the same manner that Jacob instructed his sons to carry his funeral bier to Machpelah. Whether that's true or not, don't know for sure, but that's what tradition says. But it's an interesting point to consider. Now, each of the camp banners, which would be four, contained the colors of the three tribes within that camp. Again, each individual tribe had their distinctive banner. And those tribal banners, by the way, are believed to be the same color as the particular tribe's stone on the choshen, or the breastplate. So the tribal banners, not the banners of the camps, but the tribal ensigns were as follows, according to the Midrash anyway. Reuben's was red with dudaim, or mandrakes. Of course, the mandrakes are some type of plant, and this is, of course, what he brought to his mother in the book of Genesis. And this is why Rachel came and wanted some of this, her son's mandrakes, and that's why Leah got to be with Jacob that night, and the result was Issachar. Simeon, his ensign was green with the city of Shechem, or Shechem, and the reason for that is, and in Genesis chapter 34, verse 25, we understand that Simeon killed the males of Shechem because of the situation with his sister Dinah. Levi, his ensign was white, black, and red with the Urim v'Tumim embroidered on it. And by the way, even though Levi had an ensign, they were not assigned to these four camps. Again, they were separated. They were distinguished. They were not mustered for battle. They functioned in the sanctuary. They camped around the sanctuary, separate from the rest of Israel. And so even though we're mentioning their ensign, they were not part of the four camps. Judah's ensign was sky blue with a lion. Issachar's was blue-black with the sun and the moon embroidered on it to demonstrate Issachar's knowledge of the times, according to 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 32. Zebulun's ensign was white with a ship upon it. Dan, sapphire with a snake. Gad, his was gray with a battalion or a troop, which is the meaning of God, with a troop of soldiers. Naphtali was pale red, and that was embroidered with a doe or a hind. Asher's was a bluish green with an olive tree embroidered on it. And then Ephraim's was black with an ox or a bull's head. And Manasseh's was black with Raim, which is some unknown beast. It was a wild bull, some suppose, but I don't know for sure. I don't think anyone really knows for sure. So that's why we'll just transliterate it as Raim, because that's what the Bible says. Benjamin's ensign was a mixture of all the other colors with a wolf embroidered on it. So that was the tribal banners, the 12 tribes. The camp banners, which were four, of course, that was divided into Judah's camp, Reuben's camp, Ephraim's camp, and Dan's camp. And the camp banners for Judah was the lion, Reuben's was the face of a man, Ephraim was an ox or a bull, and Dan was an eagle. And so we have all these different banners, all these different colors, etc. But nevertheless, all these different banners and tribes constituted one people with the Mishkan in their midst. And that's one of those things that I feel can't be mentioned enough. They had all of these distinct and unique qualities, but at the same time, the thing we need to understand is that it was because they were one people with the Mishkan in the midst. Now, one tradition has it that the camp formed a quadrilateral. In other words, four square with the Mishkan in the center. In fact, that center portion was called the camp of the Shekinah, or the Shekinah, or the presence. And so that particular camp, the camp of the Shekinah, consisted of the Mishkan itself. And then to the east, we have Aaron and Moses and the sons of Aaron. And then we have the Kohathites and the Gerarites and the Merarites surrounding it. And so That collectively was what was called the camp of the Shekinah, and that is what sat in the center of this overall camp. Again, according to one tradition, it was a quadrilateral. It was four square. But another tradition has it being similar to the layout of the Mishkan itself. In other words, actually resembling a cross laid on its side. And this tradition is based on the fact that you have all these different populations of the different camps mentioned for us. For instance, the camp of Judah, which consisted of Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The population of that camp was 186,400. Reuben's camp to the south, which consisted of Reuben, Simeon, and Gad, was 151,450 people. Ephraim's camp, which consisted of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, which was situated to the west, had a population of 108,100. And then the camp of Dan, which consisted of Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, was 157,600 people. So here's the point. The logic of this different configuration of the camp is based on the populations and the directions in which these camps were told to camp. For instance, Judah was to camp east, not northeast and not southeast, but directly east. Because if Judah just spread out to the east and then kind of it went over into the northeast quadrant and then to the southeast quadrant, well, you could suppose that Reuben to the south and Dan to the north would be kind of doing the same thing. Dan would be going to the north, but he might be drifting off into the northeast as well. Reuben goes south, but might be drifting off to the southeast. And if Judah's doing that, same thing, then you've got these different camps kind of overlapping and mixing with one another. And so this other tradition has it that when Judah was told to camp to the east, it meant to the east. And so Judah, having the largest population of these four camps, would extend the farthest distance from the sanctuary. Now, Ephraim, which is on the west, opposite of Judah's camp, had the smallest population. So it would extend out the least amount of distance from the Mishkan and the camp of the Shekinah. If you compare Dan's camp and Reuben's camp, there's only 6,000, or actually less than 6,000 people's difference. So in other words, they were very similar in population. So Dan to the north and Reuben to the south would extend out in equidistances, more or less, from the Mishkan. And so the end result would be that this would look like the layout of the Mishkan itself, or if you will, it kind of resembles a cross laid on its side, which is kind of interesting. Now, understanding this, and then understanding their banners. Judah's to the east was a lion. Dan's to the north was an eagle. Ephraim's to the west was an ox or a bull. And Reuben's to the south was the man's face. All of that puts in mind the heavenly courtroom or the heavenly throne room. In fact, the Midrash teaches that the camp in the wilderness was a counterpart of God's throne room. Because in God's throne room, he is surrounded by four living creatures, which is identical to the emblems of the four camps. Let me read to you from Revelation chapter 4, verse 6. It says, "Before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures full of eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf." An ox or a bull, if you will. The third living creature had face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. The four living creatures, each having six wings, were full of eyes around and within, and they do not rest day or night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And so what we see is that in the throne room of God, you have these four living creatures that surround him, presumably. What are they doing? They're reciting holy, 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 day and night. They are guarding that sanctity, if you will. And so what we see here is that in the camp in the wilderness, that is a facsimile of what we see in the heavens. In fact, Moses was told to make everything after the pattern that he saw in the mountain. In Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle, for he said, "See that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." And so if the original that Moses saw in the mountain was God's throne room, which according to tradition, that's what happened, that he saw God's throne room, more or less, he saw the original Ark of the Covenant, the original Table of Showbread, etc. And so if all those things that we see in the tabernacle itself was to be arranged and patterned after what he was shown in the mountain, then it seems logical that the way the people would camp around the Mishkan, or around the throne on earth, if you will, because that's what the Ark of the Covenant really represents, that the way they would encamp around him would be a facsimile of what is in his heavenly throne room. And so when the Mishkan was established and the Shekinah resided in the Mishkan, in a sense, God was surrounded by the four camps or the four living creatures. And one had the face of a man, one had the face of an eagle, one had the face of a lion, and one had the face of an ox or a bull or a calf. And so all this is to say, once again, that the camp in the wilderness resembles the throne room of God, because the whole reason for the Mishkan was God said, "I want them to build me a sanctuary that I may dwell in them." Now, there's an interesting point made in relation to Judah's camp, because Judah goes first. Judah's toward the east, Judah goes out first. In the camp of Judah, you have Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Issachar is associated with study of the Torah because of the sons of Issachar who understood the times and they knew what Israel ought to do, and all the people were at their command. That's in 1 Chronicles 12. So Issachar is associated with Torah study, understanding the word, etc., where Judah is associated with the king, the royal tribe. Zebulun is associated with wealth. So here is the interesting point. Judah is at the head. And behind Judah, directly behind Judah, is Issachar, denoting Judah's need for Torah scholars, or if you will, Issachar. Zebulun, which represents wealth, is behind Issachar, removing the influence of wealth from direct contact with the king, or Judah, because those types of temptations can be dangerous for a king. And so the first thing, or the closest thing to him, is going to be those who study the Torah, and then those who represent wealth. "Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you." I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing to consider. Now in verse 10, considering that Judah's camp went first, the honor of leading the second formation was given to Reuben, because Reuben, it says, represents repentance. His position to the south was associated with blessings of dew and rain. And so, rabbinically, it's understood that the south is equivalent to blessings of dew and rain, because blessing comes as a result of repentance. Now, in verse 17, it says, "The tent of meeting shall journey in the middle of the camps." And rabbis debate just where the tabernacle fit into the camps. But the point is this: it was central to the movement of the camp. That was the most important thing. Even though Judah went first, the Mishkan was journeying in the midst of the camps, and that was still the most important thing, even while they're traveling. It's still called the tent of meeting, even when it was disassembled. Because once again, just because it was dismantled, and just because it was in transit, does not mean it lost any of its sanctity. And so this serves to teach that God's house, which are his people, are always to conduct themselves as his people, to retain that sanctity. He's holy, therefore we're to be holy. We must maintain our being set apart in any and all circumstances. See, God doesn't alter his holiness, and as his people, we should strive not to do that as well. Even though we are scattered about, even though the house is disassembled in a sense, Nevertheless, it is to remain holy or set apart. Because, again, we are not to have profaned his name among the nations, but unfortunately we see that his people have not been faithful to that call, because he tells us on many occasions, you have profaned my name among the nations. Now in verse 18, Ephraim's position, of course, was to the west, which rabbinically it's understood to be the place of extreme weather. So the west is associated with extreme weather, which I find very interesting. Now, there are two possibilities for this. That is, that Ephraim would be placed in an area that is subjected to extreme weather. The first possibility, or the first reason given, is because Ephraim is subjected to this because of his sin. Of course, Ephraim, the northern kingdom, was under Jeroboam, was the kingdom that established the two altars and the two golden calves and Dan and Bethel, which caused Israel to go astray. The second possibility that's given is, at the other end of the spectrum, that these three tribes, that is Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin, which constitutes the camp of Ephraim, that these three tribes possessed the strength of character to withstand these difficult circumstances, this extreme weather, if you will. Here's one other thing to consider. God's presence was actually on the western side of the sanctuary, closer to Ephraim, in a sense, than it was to Judah. In fact, in the temple, the Holy of Holies in the temple was actually situated in Benjamin's portion, not Judah's portion. In fact, in Deuteronomy 33:12, of Benjamin he said, "The beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him, who shelters him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders." So literally, God's presence dwelt in the territory given to Benjamin, not territory given to Judah. And so it's just kind of interesting. If Judah is in close proximity to the study of Torah, that is Issachar, as we were mentioning a while ago, and if Ephraim, who is in the west, is in closer proximity to the presence, does this have prophetic ramifications? In other words, the two branches of the olive tree and their respective roles to the unity of Israel under the Messiah. Let's put it this way. If Ephraim is closer to the presence and Judah is closer to the Torah, then it would seem that Judah needs to learn some things from Benjamin or Ephraim, and Ephraim needs to glean some things from Judah, and they need to have a meeting of the minds. And so if you consider in that camp that Judah needs to come over to where Ephraim is, and Ephraim needs to come over to where Judah is, in other words, they would have to meet in the sanctuary in order to be united, because the sanctuary was the spoke in this particular wheel. Now in verse 25, we see that Dan's camp was in the north, which the word there is Zaphonah. Zaphonah, which is synonymous with Zaphon, and Zaphon is the word for north, but it is also literally the word hidden, because the north is symbolized by darkness. And so Dan is associated with darkness, some say in the fact that Dan is associated with Jeroboam setting up the altar and the idol in his particular territory, in Tel Dan. And of course, as I said, this eventually led to the exile of the northern kingdom. Nevertheless, the camp of Dan included the tribe of Asher, and Asher is emblematic of oil. In other words, oil provides the fuel for light, that light in darkness. Also, the camp of Dan included the tribe of Naphtali, which is blessed with favor. So here's what we're getting at. Sometimes darkness, Zaphon, is not a bad thing, because Joseph was hidden, because that's the literal meaning of it. In fact, Joseph was known as Zaphnat, which comes from Zaphon, Zaphnat Paneach. So there's different ways of looking at this. And in fact, Dan's position is not called fourth, but last. Now, the spelling of Dan, or Dan, is Dalet Nun. And rabbinically, it is understood that the Dalet and the Nun of Dan actually forms the letter Tav, which is the last of the Hebrew letters. But when we refer to the Tav as being last, we don't mean that it's somehow derogatory or somehow subservient or inferior. No, we just mean that it's last, but in the sense of a seal. The Tav is going to seal everything that came before. Dan means to judge. And so God, as judge, seals his decrees at the last. Not only that, but Moses described Dan as being a lion. And that would imply that the camp needs a lion at the head, that's Judah, and a lion at the last. And the Messiah, who is the lion of the tribe of Judah, is also the first and last, which is to say he is the forward and the rear guard. Now look at what Isaiah 52 has to say. For you shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight. For the Lord will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard. So not only does he go before us as the first, but he comes at the last. He is the rear guard. He is the first and last. So we see in the camps that there is all of this symbolism. And in Dan, which a lot of people want to associate with some negative connotation, and I'm not saying that there isn't some negative connotations to consider, but Dan is in fact called in Numbers chapter 10, verse 25, the rear guard of all the camps. So maybe he's last, not in the sense of being inferior, but the seal, and emblematic of the fact that a lion is the rear guard, and in Judah, a lion is the front guard. And that speaks to us of ultimately Yeshua. Now, in chapter 3, we see the Levites, the duties that were given to the Levites, and the different division of the Levites. In verse 1, of course, it says the generation, which really means the offspring of Aaron and Moses. So chapter 3 is going to tell us about the offspring of Aaron and Moses, and yet when it starts mentioning the offspring, only Aaron's sons are mentioned. Because see, technically Aaron's sons are the Kohanim, and Moses' sons are merely Levites. Yet Moses taught Torah to Aaron and his sons, and so in a sense he is their spiritual father, because a man's influence can extend beyond his biological offspring. In fact, sometimes a man's influence has a better job or has a better chance of extending to beyond his biological offspring. Because sometimes, and I was guilty of this growing up, sometimes your own sons and daughters have a harder time hearing from you than someone else's sons and daughters. I'm not saying that's the way it's supposed to be. I'm just saying that sometimes that's the way it is. Now in verse 6, it says that the Levites are given in service to the priests, which would also signify that the high priest is ultimately responsible for the sanctity of the Mishkan. In verse 9, it emphasizes that the Levites are given to the priests by literally saying in Hebrew that they are given. So the same words used twice to really emphasize that this is whole, this is complete. The verse again designates that Levi is distinguished from the rest of Israel. They are set apart. But here's something to consider. Israel is to be set apart. So the Levites are, in effect, set apart from those who are already set apart. Now the Levites were to safeguard the priesthood. That is, they were to maintain its sanctity, which some rabbinical sources suggest that means that they were to prevent aliens from having anything to do with the priesthood and getting anywhere near the things that were considered holy. Now, if the Levites are set apart from those who are set apart, that is Israel, then understand that the priests were distinguished even further. That is, the priests were set apart from the Levites, who were set apart from Israel, who was set apart. Now, in verse 15, Levi, we see, is counted a second time. And this time, it's from the ages of 30 through 50 to see who is eligible for temple service. So levy is counted a second time to see who's eligible for temple service, and they've already been counted to see who's even a Levite, and etc. But anyway, we've got all these distinctions made within the distinctions. So you've got the Kohanim, the priests, the Levim, the Levites, and Yisraeli, the Israelites, corresponding to the Holy of Holies, because only a Kohen could stand in the Holy of Holies. And then the Holy Place. The Levites could go into the Holy Place. And then the Israelites. They could go into the courtyard. So what I'm getting at is this. There are those who are set apart, but then there are those who are set apart from those who are set apart. And then it would seem that there are an even smaller remnant who are set apart from those set apart from those set apart. Psalm 24 says this in verses 3 through 4, "Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart." Here's the point. Only the priests could stand in the holy place. And only the high priest could stand in the most holy place. And so we understand that Yeshua is our heavenly high priest, but we are to be priests unto him. So in other words, we want to be those who stand in his holy place. But if we're going to be able to do that, then that means we're going to have a pure heart, and we're going to have clean hands in that we can handle the holy things. So in other words, perhaps this is indicating that we must be striving to be more than just set apart, but to be set apart from those already set apart. In other words, this is inferring that the bride is distinguished from the guest, and the bride is distinguished from the friends. I hope I'm making sense here. I don't want to be just those who stand in the court. I want to be those who stand in the holy place. And that means I'm going to have clean hands and a pure heart. By the way, the word pure is bar, which is also the word for son. So again, we have the nation called Israel that's a set apart nation. But then we've got those who are set apart within the nation, the Levim. But then we've got those among the Levim who are set apart even further. So apparently we have an example, or we have a pattern, maybe would be the more proper word, of how the Creator calls people out of the courtyard to come into the holy place, to be set apart even further from those who are already set apart. Now in verse 12, God says, "I have taken the Levites," literally to say, "I am taking them," which is to say, they're mine. "He takes them instead of every firstborn." Because the sanctity of the firstborn sons of Israel was established at least from the time of the slaying of the firstborn in Egypt. And there are implications that the sanctity of the firstborn goes all the way back to the beginning. In fact, in Exodus chapter 24, verse 4, look here, "And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord. And he rose up early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord." So two things that are very interesting. This is before the golden calf incident. And so these young men are, it is believed anyway, to be firstborn sons of Israel. Because originally God calls Israel to be a kingdom of priests, not just one tribe. But at the worship of the golden calf, the firstborn forfeited those privileges. It's just like in 1 Chronicles 5, we see that Reuben forfeited his rights as the firstborn to Joseph because he defiled his father's bed. So likewise, the firstborn of Israel, when they got involved with this worship of the calf, they forfeited their rights to function as priest to the Levites. And so the Levites were chosen, and God says, "I am taking them, they are mine." But they are chosen in the stead of the firstborn, because we understand from the text that the Levites resisted the temptation to engage in the worship of the golden calf. And God adds this in verse 13, "I am Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, I am the Lord," which is to be understood. Look, I'm not the one who changed. The firstborn, they're the ones who changed. And now I'm choosing Levi to be my priests, to be my firstborn, so to speak. Levi is his legion, and they are assigned to teaching the people about the Torah and to teach the people to distinguish between clean and unclean. That's the way it was in the past, and by the way, that's what it's going to be in the future. That same thing is going to hold true. Those who kept his charge, according to Ezekiel 44, verse 23, will teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. Now, there's a footnote to this. The sages teach that the firstborn sons of Israel will eventually return to their former state, which that is a hint that there is a distinguished priesthood from the Levitical priesthood. And of course, as you know, the scriptures speak of the Melchizedek order. I'm not saying that this firstborn returning to their former state constitutes that. It's just an interesting concept to consider. Nevertheless, the above scripture in Ezekiel 44 tells us this, that those who remained clean, those who kept his charge, were of Levi, and they were of the sons of Zadok. Now the Levites were divided into groups, just like Israel was divided into groups. And these different divisions of the Levites camped around the Mishkan in this manner. The Gershonites, Gershon was the firstborn, camped to the west, and the Gershonites transported the tapestries, i.e. the tent. The Kohathites camped to the south, and they transported the holy furniture. And this was the most notable of the three divisions of the Levites. The Merarites camped to the north, and they transported the boards, the pillars, and the sockets. The east side of the tabernacle, which was the most honored place, was reserved for Moses, Aaron, and the Kohanim. Now, if Moses and Aaron and his sons had the most honored place in the east, the second most honored place was to the south, and that was the Kohathites. And the Kohathites are the ones who carried the holy furniture. Here's why this is interesting. Because the Kohathites included Korach and his family. And of course, Korach is going to start a rebellion. And so those who were assigned to carrying the furniture, the most holy things in the tabernacle, the most holy things associated with the tabernacle, include Korach and his family. And if the Kohathites are camped to the south, and Reuben's camp is to the south, then that means that Reuben's camp and the tribe of Reuben was the closest to the Kohathites. And that's interesting because when Korach does initiate his rebellion, there's going to be a lot of sons of Reuben who become entangled in that rebellion. And it's interesting, in light of American history, to see that this rebellion came from the south. Now in chapter 4, moving right along, we see the rules for service. And in verse 2, we were just mentioning the Kohathites. The Kohathites were favored with carrying the furniture, and the Kohathites were organized in verse 2 and 3, and they're qualified by age for service, and it actually literally means for warfare. In other words, those of the Levites, when they were qualified, when they were counted, they were being organized for warfare. Because those who serve the Creator, let's face it, we're in a war. That warfare is not carnal. We don't war against flesh and blood, but we war against principalities. Nevertheless, I would like to add this. In my opinion, my greatest adversary is not HaSatan. My greatest adversary is me. So it's interesting that the Levites were divided up into groups and they were qualified for warfare, it says literally. It's translated service in most translations, but literally means warfare. Now, it's interesting to point out that Gershon was the firstborn of Levi, and Kohath was the secondborn. Because Gershon didn't get to carry the holy furniture, Kohath did. Firstborn didn't get to carry the things that would be considered the most sacred. The secondborn did. Throughout the scripture, when you think the primacy should be placed upon the firstborn, a lot of times we see that it's actually on the secondborn. For instance, Cain and Abel. Cain's the firstborn, Abel's the secondborn. who's righteous and who's of the wicked one. Ishmael and Isaac. The firstborn is Ishmael, Isaac, secondborn. But who does God propagate the seed of Abraham through? And then we come to Esau and we come to Jacob. Esau's the firstborn, Jacob's the secondborn. But who does God love and who does God reject? So there is something to do with this secondborn, and our good friend Brad Scott makes this point. God didn't say that the firstborn that man puts his seed into is set apart as far as God is concerned. But it's the firstborn that God puts his seed into. And so it's not Ishmael, in other words, it's through Isaac shall your seed be called. Not to mention that the Kohathites were of the same family that Moses and Aaron were in. Now in verse 5, Aaron, we see, as we begin to transport the tabernacle, was to cover the holy things first. And this was to be done without the Kohathites touching the furniture or even gazing upon it. In fact, it would mean death for them. The ark, we see, was covered with the veil, and then it was covered with a blue tachash skin, or some say seal skins. Now, just thought about this earlier. It seems to me that the veil, considering the size, to cover the ark, that would have been rather large. And then it's going to be covered again by this other skin. At any rate, it was covered, and then it was carried by the staves. And the fact that it was covered before it could be transported accentuates the sanctity of these things. So the priests had to prepare these things for transport so that the Kohathites would not die. Remember, Uzziah was struck dead for touching the ark. They didn't treat it the way they were supposed to treat it. They didn't transport it the way they were supposed to transport it. And as a result, somebody ends up dead. Because how we treat God's holy things is very important. How we carry His message is very important as well. And so we shouldn't carry it flippantly. The priests were pointed there to make sure that those who were transporting it, the Levites, and especially the Kohathites, the priests were appointed to oversee this so that these Levites did not overstep their bounds. Because if not, if the priests had not been there to officiate and to kind of supervise, there's a possibility that some of them would have been killed. Now in verse 10, we see the menorah is going to have to be transported, but we understand that the menorah didn't have staves like the ark and like the golden altar and like the table of shewbread. So we see that it's placed in a bag-like receptacle, and then it's carried upon a pole. In verse 13, the altar, the brazen altar that is, was also transported, and this brings up a question. What about the fact that the fire was to be perpetual that burned in the brazen altar? How did they transport it? Was the fire extinguished? Some say yes, some opinions say no. Verse 16, notice that the priest Eleazar is personally appointed to carry the oil and the incense. Because these things too were considered most holy. Now in verse 20 it says, as they are being covered, that word that's used there, covered in Hebrew, actually means to divide or to destroy. And so in verse 20 it says, as these holy things are being divided or destroyed, obviously they're not being destroyed, but what is it saying? Well, it's being disassembled. It's being divided. And so the verse there in verse 20 is emphasizing that those who are responsible for transporting the holy furnishings, etc., are not to look upon the holy furniture. Why? Because they should not think that just because it's being disassembled, that it has lost any of its sanctity, and so consequently be tempted to mishandle it. To us, this would say, that the sanctuary has been divided, so to speak. It has been scattered all over the earth. His people, know you not that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit? And so His sanctuary has been divided. It's been scattered. Nevertheless, we should not look upon this as an excuse to mishandle the sanctity of His house. It was disassembled solely for the purpose of transporting it to another location. That's all. And so in a sense, once again, it's been transported to another location. It's spread out all over the world in you and in me. And so we, as His people, have a responsibility to retain that sanctity, to maintain that holiness that is His in the eyes of other people by living our lives in a way that sanctifies His name rather than profanes His name. Also consider that each group that was given their little part of transporting the sanctuary, they had to keep their charge because when it was time to reassemble it, they needed to be able to present their part of it. So in Amos chapter 9, verse 11, which speaks of the restoration of David's fallen tabernacle and repairing the breaches, etc., that is a prophecy that looks forward to the United Kingdom of Israel and everything being in its proper place and being set up at the proper time, which if we have been given a part of this as individuals, as a body, if we've been given a part to play, a role to play, a thing that we are to do, a mission that we are to fulfill, then we are to responsible to do just that and to present our part when it comes time to set up this tabernacle once again. And with that, we'll come to the close of the Torah portion called Bamidbar. We thank you for joining us. Until next time, Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BuildCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BuildCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.